And welcome to the session on identity brokers. I won't read the whole title. My name is Phil Windley. John asked me to moderate this panel. It's never quite clear when you're asked to moderate whether you're being asked to moderate because you're considered knowledgeable and able to guide the panel or because you don't know anything and so they think you'll be fair. But I'll leave that for you to decide. We modified the description just slightly from what is printed in the program, and it didn't get into the program. Let me read you the description that we came up with, or at least I think we came up with. I think everybody agrees. Very likely there will be a new industry of identity brokers, identity providers, and relying parties using those digital identities. Will it become subject to power laws and vendor concentration? What forces will play a role in shaping this new industry? The Higgins open source software framework is one emerging implementation for identity systems that allows for interoperability and integration, utilizing open identity protocols. What might its role be in helping enable this new industry? What role will other systems play? How might new identity systems be used or abused by governments, corporations, and large organizations through national identity cards and GUIDs, global unique identifiers? So slightly different than what's in the program. What I thought we'd do today as a matter of getting started is to have each of the panelists introduce themselves, say a few words, and then really open it up to questions. I have a few questions to get things started. I hope really to get some terms defined to begin with, but what we really want is for your questions to help guide the panel. So as people introduce themselves and as they answer some of my initial questions, please be thinking of questions and feel free to ask them. Why don't we start on the opposite end of the panel? And we'll start with Mike and come this way.
Good morning. I'm Michael Graves. I am the Chief Technical Officer for VeriSign Information Services, and that's the naming and DNS division of VeriSign, if you're familiar with them at all. And I am, in addition to that title, I'm the lead tip of the spear, technically, for our efforts in identity infrastructure. It's one of our new and broad initiatives to establish a commons-based infrastructure practice at VeriSign, centering around digital identity and involving reputation and attendant services.
I'm Mike Jones. I'm at Microsoft, and I'm one of the primary people going out and talking to the world about our identity meta system initiative that we're doing with many of the rest of the folks here. And in short, it's about allowing individuals to produce and send claims from any identity that they have to any relying party wanting to use those claims. And as we get into the panel, I'll talk some more about how, you know, we as technologists may have thought we were building a solution for sign-in and for authentication, where in fact people are already starting to use these ideas to do a whole lot more. And that's pretty exciting.
I'm Drummond Reed. I'm CTO at Cordance and co-chair of the XRI and XDI technical committees at OASIS. XRI is Extensible Resource Identifier. It's a new digital addressing system for people and companies and things. And I'm also the secretary at XDI.org, which is I believe the first organization that has put together a federation of iBrokers that will officially be launching tonight at the demo ceremony MIT Labs. Be opening a global registry service for XRIs, and some of the iBrokers are here attending. We invite you all to come.
Good morning. I'm Raj Nagaratnam. I'm from IBM. I'm the chief identity architect at IBM. So in addition to working on some of the identity and identity management products, also responsible for the identity integration across our middleware stack and platforms. So from that viewpoint, we look at identity system, meta system from multiple perspectives. End user is definitely one of the key players, but in addition to that, we do look at the aspects of administration because from enterprise viewpoint and how information need to be aggregated, managed in a consistent way, because more and more information is duplicated, risk of data loss come into play. So in addition to the discussions around relying party tokens, claims that's being discussed in detail at this conference, one of the key things that's not discussed is around how do you manage identities from information, identity data perspective, and policies associated with it. So there's an aspect of that that need to be factored in. And so you're full force with those concepts, including developers. That's why our participation from Higgins in Higgins come into play. So some of those concepts we'll discuss probably in more detail later.
I'm Paul Trevithick. I'm with an association consortium called Social Physics. It's loosely affiliated with Berkman. And we share a vision with a number of people that the internet needs an open, trusted infrastructure, open source, free to the end user, that works on their behalf, that protects them, that adds control to the individual, gives them more control over their digital information, personal information, even social networks, even relationships. So we define it very broadly. In order to get towards that vision, actually Phil started, and I've been doing a lot with the thing called identitygang.org, which among its goals is to try and come up with a common lexicon, because a lot of us talk past each other using different words. And another part towards the vision is the development of something we call Higgins, which you'll hear more about. Higgins is an open source identity framework which can play a part in building that infrastructure. And my particular interest, if you really ask me who I am, I work for Doc Searles. That was the broad vision, but the narrow vision is I work for him because I'm trying to build the empowered customer. And some of the demos tonight you'll see will show what happens when a customer goes to a Best Buy site. We've built a demo with my virtual model in Best Buy and can project anonymously information about their preferences. What's the web like when I have control over my stuff and want to project it?
Sometimes I think we ought to start these out with the demos, because I think it would save us a lot of time in coming up with a common mental model before we get started. As part of coming up with that common mental model and answering and getting some baseline established here, on the internet, interoperability is achieved with IP, and on top of that, UDP or TCP. Where is the interoperability coming from in the identity space? Is it going to be a common protocol? Are there multiple protocols and multiple layers that need to exist? Maybe that analogy doesn't work. Tell me about interoperability. All right, then.
So...
an easier question.
That's a hard one, actually.
I can possibly take a first stab at it. Interoperability, interoperability and then integration aspects, some people do consider integration of systems in the context of interoperability as well. So if you look at interoperability, there's protocol interoperability, and there may be different, depending on the use cases, there may be different protocols, but hopefully not too many from the usage perspective. So discussions like LID and others that we have been having, and then WS Trust, like a flexible infrastructure from addressing multiple protocols, token types along this space come into play. So I would say from... interoperability, again, from end-user perspective, it's about what they are accessing and how they can access the relaying parties, their service providers, so to say. So from that viewpoint, the clients need to be interoperable so that they can provide their claims in an appropriate way. So there's one aspect of interoperability. The other is when ID providers, a set of them, work towards a meta system, they may need to exchange not only claims but also information and also policies be it privacy policies or constraints with respect to how one can use the data. So interoperability comes in multiple flavors of data exchange, tokens or claim exchange, policies. Therefore, depending on security is in the context of what is being tried, like accessing services. So that does play a role, but I think there's a need for, there may not be only one, but we need to evolve towards at least a few.
So identity is such a fascinating area, exactly because it's about identifying yourself to others who are not yourself. If everyone was in the same organization, there wouldn't be a problem to solve. But in fact, we're in different organizations, we're in different social circles, we're, you know, members of many different organizations and may use different identities in those different organizations. And, you know, if just Microsoft or just IBM or just, you know, any consortium was to ship a set of identity protocols, it would be about as useful as if, you know, only IBM shipped the internet protocol. At that point, you could only talk to IBM devices with it. And yet, in order to identify yourself to things that are not yourself, you still have to have agreement among both parties on what protocols you'll speak. And so I'm in this very interesting role where I'm out trying to build consensus around a particular set of protocol choices that we've worked on with a number of others in the industry, that, you know, Microsoft can't impose this, IBM can't impose it, maybe VeriSign can. You could work on that, Michael. But and I'll get Doc a Chevy Cavalier in his user preference world. But anyway, we will only get to an interoperable identity world when we all decide to do it together. And the good news I have to report from, you know, the discussions such as these and those with lots of the leading companies here and around the world is people understand the need for this. I'm not saying that we're yet there to the point that everyone's deployed WS Trust or, you know, however we think it's going to come out. But, you know, some very unprecedented things have already happened, such as, you know, my friend Mike Shaver at Mozilla and I going to Amazon and eBay and Yahoo and Google together. It changes the game from how is Microsoft going to do any of this to these two parties don't usually collaborate on things. Maybe there's something happening here that we're going to take note of. And so I'm very heartened by the sense of community that has developed, you know, as demonstrated on this panel and in this room, that there's a set of problems which, if we don't solve them together, they won't be solved. But the good news is I think we are solving them together.
So I can be just a curmudgeon on the panel here for this question anyway. I think there is, all these points are good ones, but there's a meta interop problem that we're struggling with, I think making progress toward. But I, as someone who worked a long time ago on the stack implementations for TCP/IP, that was a whole lot of work. But I remember back to those days when there wasn't a lot of semantic fuzziness about it, and there's a huge sort of anthropological problem around identity that we didn't have when we were trying to implement the TCP/IP stack. We understood what we were talking about, that A meant A and B meant B, and you get a lot of overloading in the language around identity. What does trust really mean? And you end up having these deep philosophical, intractable discussions about what trust means and what an identifier really is. And I think that part of the interop problem is being able to get language interop working or social interop working between all the different parties, because a lot of the people at this table come and in this room come at a lot of the terms from very different directions. So I think we're sort of consolidating around that, but the big progress really is interoperating on a conceptual framework as a predicate for interop at the technical and the wire format layer.
And I want to take on what Michael just said. The We don't currently, and I know this for a fact, if John Clippinger is here in the room, we don't have consensus on the term iBroker. We could probably spend the rest of the panel on that, but there's some deeper things that I think that reveals. One of the things, and the way I'll use the term right here, in reference to Phil's question, is one of the key roles that I think is surfacing for iBrokers is to make the question that Phil asked not matter at all to the user. In other words, the purpose, one of the first purposes of an iBroker and user-centric identity systems is so that users don't have to care squat about the protocols. They don't care. They won't see them. They won't understand any more than they understand how these cards are moving bits around to pay for things. What do users know about the back ends of their banks? They just know that there's some place they can go. They can swipe the card. They recognize the brands, and they say, this is a Visa, this is a MasterCard, what works? And most of those have found ways to interoperate, too. So I'll give you a very tangible example. 2 weeks ago, XDI.org, that is you know, the governance body for a set of iBrokers that are going to interoperate, they faced, it was a longstanding question. For 2 years, they had been working to develop a SAML profile that all the iBrokers would use to interoperate so that any customer of any iBroker could know that anyone that wanted to authenticate, any of their customers, could use the SAML profile to do that. Meanwhile, the lightweight identity systems had come along, and OpenID has gotten a lot of traction. And finally, there was this decision. What are they going to do about OpenID? And the decision actually was fairly easy in the end. It was, all right, we're going to support both of them. And it's not a choice of either or. It's to say, from the customer's perspective, it's not going to matter. All they have to know is they've got an identity with an iBroker, and any place they go, in this case the identifier is an iName, any place that's accepted, it's going to work. They're going to be able to authenticate. They're going to be able to exchange data. It's going to be like a credit card. So one of the things that I believe the term iBroker ends out coming to mean, and this is very different than the term identity provider as it's been used in the industry in relationship to a lot of protocols. And an iBroker's role is to actually handle multiple protocols, to be able to abstract and simplify the job for the end user, the customer, whether it's an individual or a business. Very much the way an ISP turns around and says, I don't care what all, you know, I'll handle all those technical protocols. I just give you email and web hosting and the other services you expect.
My view is that we're not going to converge very, very quickly to a single protocol. And even if we were moving towards single protocol, there's an enormous legacy of existing systems and stuff out there that we can't ignore. So my bet is, and this is why we work on the Higgins framework, it's not a particular protocol. You can plug implementations of a protocol into it. So we think that frameworks are important. We've all talked about the need for a common language. One thing that hasn't been mentioned so far going down the line is, and Microsoft deserves some good credit for this, is the need for a common user experience. So interoperability, you might interpret the question as just bits and bytes and protocols, but in fact, if the end user, if the person is presented with five different ways to drive a car, sometimes steering wheel on the left and sometimes, you know, two levers in the back seat, it's not going to work. The average person is like some of their information in 700 different silos. We'd like a consistent way to understand and manage stuff about me, whether it's credentials, whether it's banking information. And how do you consistently sign in? How does the person know? I mean, a lot of what actually motivates Microsoft is fighting, you know, phishing attacks and things like that. The way you fight some of this stuff is through consistent experience. So the person knows, this doesn't feel right. Why are they asking me that? They shouldn't be asking me that at this time. So maybe that's not what you wanted by that.
Thank you. Let me acknowledge an elephant in the room. We have Higgins. We have CardSpace now, right? Is that the right name? We have CardSpace. We have XDI, which is in some ways a framework for the iBrokers to interchange protocols. How do these relate to each other? Are they competing standards to be the IP of the internet? Are they different layers? I'm sorry, identity to be the IP of identity? Are they different layers? Are they solving different problems? Are they complementary? Let me discuss that.
You want to take that first? You want me to?
Doesn't matter. I'll start. our objective in the Higgins framework, one of the objectives is to make sure that we have not only complete interoperability with card space, but functional equivalence. That means you can fire up a Macintosh and you can buy a book on Amazon and it'll feel pretty much the same. You know, the steering wheel will be on the left and the driving, you know. So that to me sounds like complementarity. Someone could say, oh, it's competing. Macs compete with Windows. You know, that's a ridiculous way of looking at it. I think that would be part of my answer. I guess the XDI question, I'm more feeling that that's a technology that should be embraced, and it has some particularly interesting powers that move control to the end user. One of my hot buttons is I think that the individual person needs to have recourse. They need to be able to decide, I don't need to have to trust if I can take my stuff and move it without any ripple effect. I say, yeah, I love this company, but you know what? They should have a nice big we're fired, you know, you're fired button, and all your data comes to you and you move it somewhere else. So that's why I think some of the XDI and iName and has some interesting powers. So
yeah, I'll second that. Indeed, one of the things I love about the iName work is, unlike email ISPs today, where, you know, if I have an Earthlink account and I decide I'm disgusted with them and I go to Comcast or AOL or MSN, my email address changes. And then I have to, you know, contact everyone that I want to be able to find me again, and it's a big pain. And the iName stuff provides that level of indirection such that you can have a contact address that is independent of the particular business providing that service to you. And so I have an iName. I actually have a few. People can contact me with them. And it's very complimentary. And I'm pleased that you know, the iName brokers have decided that they'll be providing and accepting info cards as one of the means of authentication and one of the services. I expect that, well, you know, Kim went on record yesterday saying that he's going to build a OpenID-enabled info card identity provider. You know, we've learned a lot from conversations with our friend Dick Hart from Skip. In fact, made architectural changes to the software that we're shipping in Windows because we wanted to make sure that we were building a truly open platform that any type of identity token could be accepted, not just, you know, SAML or X509 or other things that are, you know, current today that we might be able to understand, but we wanted to be able to take in anything that's been invented or will be invented without having to change the software. And indeed, one of the things I'm most happy about is that, and, you know, we'll get into this in the panel in a little bit when we hit the topic of, are we enabling together a new industry and new kinds of business models? The fact that we're shipping client software and Higgins is going to ship client software for the non-Windows platforms that enable a person to take claims from any identity provider they have to and give them to any party they want to, it just opens up a world of possibilities. I mean, yeah, you could do sign-in, but you could ship the model parameters for my virtual model, and that's just as valid a application of these general identity claims as the one that, you know, we narrow technologists thought that we were building.
Can I add to that and then take a question, or you want?
Go ahead and finish, then we'll take a question.
Okay. Just want to add a couple of things and possibly even clarifications from my viewpoint on some of the statements made here. First one is, I think Paul mentioned about functional equivalence. Functional equivalence can be interpreted as competition, like Paul was saying, with a different experience. I would like to differ there. I mean, differ in the sense of, I agree, there are different perspectives. End user perspective, where you want consistent experience with the similar concepts, I'm sure the interface and how it evolve that would probably evolve as well in this area. And The other aspect is developer, or more importantly, system interoperability. From that aspect, working with multiple identity system, aggregating data, the concept around identity service or identity attribute service, that comes into play. I've not seen that in InfoCard kind of discussions or card space, and we are definitely, that's important part of Higgins. So it's I would say it's a framework so that you can plug in multiple systems to manage data. You can plug in multiple identity providers or brokers to help work with claims or tokens. So there's runtime aspect, there's management aspect, from user administration and development viewpoint that need to be factored in. And Higgins is a framework that brings them those aspects together. So from that viewpoint, that just point around, I think Mike was making, that the InfoCard is for Windows and Higgins is non-Windows. I wouldn't yet classify it that way, because Higgins is a framework across heterogeneous platforms, and InfoCard can provide the user experience in a Windows platform, and there can be open source efforts from Higgins or otherwise on Linux and others. And then there are identity system discussions, be it Active Directory, other LDAP or HR systems. So
Raj kind of covered it, but I was going to ask Mike. He said, so Higgins is for that Paul's delivering for non-Windows. Is Microsoft going to deliver Higgins on Windows?
No, I actually overspoke. And Raj was correct to correct me. Indeed, Higgins could also run, if they choose to build it that way, on Windows, if they want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it can.
The reason I said it that way was I feel like they're filling a need that Microsoft, in its business models, isn't going to fill. We're not going to ship the Premier Mac client. We'll leave that to people who want to develop Mac software. But that's just as important in the identity ecosystem as the Windows client in terms of, filling the space. As I said, in my introductory remarks, identity is about identifying yourself to things that are not yourself. And some of the people are going to choose to run on other platforms. And, we still want them to be part of this whole identity solution we're building together.
Right. And just to slides rule, codes rule. So from that viewpoint, the intent for this evening is a demo where it will run on the Higgins demo, will run on Windows platform using, for example, a Mozilla browser. So that's a proof point from a user interaction perspective as well as identity system perspective.
We have a lot of words floating around here: claims, identity provider, relying party, identity broker. Mike, did you have a slide that had a scenario on it? Is that?
Yeah, let me see if I can bring that up, a couple.
I wanted to take just a minute and make sure we're using the words and everybody's understanding the words the right way. And then I noticed a few questions in the audience. We can move out to those.
Okay. What I'm going to show you is Flash that's now amazingly about a year old of the InfoCard user experience as we were thinking of it then. It's not very different now. And the reason I want to show you this is so that you have a visceral understanding of what we're referring to in some of these terms. And indeed, when Paul was talking about common user experience, I think when you see the Higgins demo tonight, you'll see some of these same factors in play. real quick, what I have here is a mock-up of what it would be like to use the identity meta system to sign in to Amazon. So you could either log in using a username password in the normal way, or we're postulating you could click use my information card. What happens? The background fades away. You're now in this special user experience with an intentionally very limited channel of interaction, one that becomes familiar to people, predictable, one where they can only do a few things. One that's just as limited as this experience, intentionally. You know when you get to this place, you can only do a few things. You know when you're at this place, you can only do
And Mike, in this scenario, Amazon would be what we'd call a relying party, and this the set of cards up here would all be identity providers.
That they would represent identities, yes, that identity providers I have a relationship with.
Let me correct you, though. Those cards don't represent identity providers. They represent, well, I'll call them identities.
Credentials.
Credentials, which are provided by an identity provider.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, each of these... Now...
Okay, well, I don't want this to descend into an argument about jargon. I just want to make sure that some common terms are defined.
Right. Let me continue to tell it how I tell it.
Go ahead.
And then you can tell me I'm telling it wrong. So each of these cards represents a relationship with an identity provider or an identity I have, just like, you know, this is an identity I have. I can use it some places. This is a different identity I have. I can use it other places. So in this case, we're assuming that I'm going to use what's called a self-issued card to sign into Amazon. This is a card where I provided the claim values. The claims here are things like my name, my address, my email address. Nothing all that valuable, but something that our user research and site research said that most sites at initial site sign-in want these claims, and so we'll facilitate providing them. Now, we'll only send them under user consent and control. So unless I click submit, effectively saying, I'm willing to release these claims to Amazon, they don't go. But let's say that I do say submit. At that point, I've signed in. Now, no username or password was typed. And if we, together, if we accomplish nothing else, but eventually retiring the username and password is a common way to sign in, we've done a lot to increase web security. But let me show you one other aspect of this demo, which part of the panel topic was, are we enabling new business models? Are new things going to happen? Well, there's a new kind of thing that could happen through digital identity as well, which is reasonably obvious, but let me show you how it might work. So let's say I'm ready to check out. I say proceed to check out. I have my shopping cart. I can either pay with a credit card that I type in the old-fashioned way to a web form, or we're postulating that you could pay with an information card. Again, you get to this same user experience where your set of cards are shown, but in this case, a different set of cards is applicable to the interaction because these cards, or this particular card, provides claims that that relying party needs for payment. So what would that look like inside? Well, here we're postulating that in addition to some of the standard claims, which wouldn't actually have to be provided, there's a credit card account number, expiration date, security code, the same sort of thing you might imagine. Indeed, as Joaquin was saying, these cards don't necessarily represent information stored on your PC or your device. They represent a reference to an identity provider that would provide the information. In this case, the reference we're postulating is to Bank of America, which is providing a digital Visa card. And they would be providing these claim values. Notice that they're not there. That's because they're not actually locally resident. I'd have to click preview, which goes up to Bank of America, the identity provider, to get these claims. They would fill in the credit card number, account expiration code, security code, whatnot. If I click submit, what that does is it sends this set of claims, the information, from the identity provider to the relying party, in this case, from Bank of America through user control to Amazon, and they could use it for payment. This is an example of a use of digital identity in the broader sense, not just to identify myself, but to enable a new facility, in this case, online payment. And I've been given permission, actually, by Visa International when we presented this to them to say that, you know, when they saw this, they said, yeah, you could do it that way. But you know what? If you can send general claims, we could invent a new schema where we're not sending your name, we're not sending your credit card number, we're not sending any personally identifiable information at all. We could just be sending effectively a digital check, which is issued by Bank of America, sent to Amazon, and when Amazon presents that digital check to Bank of America, payment occurs. Now, again, caveat, Microsoft isn't saying this will happen. We're not advocating that it should happen. But given what we're building and what others are building, are a general platform for presenting user claims or claims from identity providers such as Bank of America to Amazon, who's willing to accept them, many, many things are possible. And my virtual mannequin could be the set of claims as well.
And Paul, my understanding is tonight's demo, we'll see analogous kinds of things happening. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, there's different demos. The one that IBM will be doing is an authentication. This is an authentication scenario. It's like, sign me in. But there's more to life than authentication, too. And some of the demos are more focused on a dynamic two-way relationship between you and the site, and not a one-shot, someone claims that this is my credit card, here it is, kind of thing.
Right. One quick thing I just want to add in the context of terminology, interesting, Paul hasn't mentioned it yet. If we consider our users' devices as entities, then the fundamental concept is we have multiple identities for those entities in a given context. So the notion of context is much more fundamental, so that the identities are scoped to tied to a context. In a runtime token claims environment, it becomes a relaying party. Or attribute, data, information, it becomes your identity provider or data store, depending on the way you look at it. So I just want to throw the notion of context in the mix.
Thanks. Somebody grab the lights, please. I think we're done with this slide. Question over here. Thank you.
I think this question is for Drummond. In this scenario that we just saw, what's the role of the iBroker?
That's a great question, Ben. And in fact, we've been working with the InfoCard team, those of us in the iName community, for almost 2 years now. And I think it's surfacing. And first, I'm going to try and clarify this difference between what I would call a digital address-based identity and card-based identity. And I think it's like talking about analog and digital or photon. These are just two different ways of accomplishing the exchange of information and establishing relationships. Addressable identity, as user-centric addressable identity, I need to have an address. And there's one good this classic scenario there is if you need to contact me as a business or another individual, then just like we need email or we need addresses, and then we need to be able to, a lot of that at the identity layer is about controlling the address. Now, the card-based metaphor says, okay, there's information we need to exchange. Now, yes, addresses are involved there, but really that becomes about agreement on the container of information and how it's going to be exchanged. Those two things are not conflicting. They're totally complementary. In fact, one of the ways we end up talking about it is turning around and saying, if you do take one of these conventional physical cards, typically it has an address on it or a name. That's one of my claims. That's one of the ways in which one of the pieces of information that I might be exchanging that's useful in its own right. But it's not saying you can only use an address or you can only use a card. There's a relationship between them. Now I'll answer your question, which is for an iBroker, one of the things that we've found for user-centric identity, if you're talking about addressable identity, you want to have a digital address, then just like with email, you need an address provider. There are very few individuals, consumers in the world, that are in a position to be running their own addressing services. They need a service provider to offer that. There's obvious use case for identity brokers. I think one of the reasons the first set of interoperable identity brokers are out there is in the digital addressing space is because they have to be there. Now, in the card-based metaphor, you don't have to have a, quote, iBroker in the middle of that transaction. The one Mike just showed you basically said, I, the user using this machine and using Microsoft software, was able to take a card from my identity provider and give it to the relying party, Amazon, without a broker in the middle. One of the first questions, though, and I've given the same demo. It's very effective in terms of helping people understand that, to a number of iBrokers, all of whom arrive at the same conclusion very quickly, which is, if I want to have if this machine goes down, right? If I lose it, if something happens, what happens to all these cards? It's like, what happens if I drop this in a lake, right? I would have to go out there and recover all these credentials, and that's a big job. Many users and potential iBrokers look at this and say, wow, isn't one of our wouldn't one of our natural functions be to help the users store and manage these, even if they're not, the iBroker is not the provider of these cards? So that's where, again, I think the distinction between an iBroker that's serving as the user's trusted intermediary. If John Clippinger was here, he would say it's a fiduciary duty. You're like a bank. You're not an identity provider. You are the user's representative, fiduciary representative, in terms of helping them manage their data, whether it's their cards or their addresses.
Can I ask a very quick follow-up?
Sure.
You implied earlier that the iBroker was going to do something about doing all the protocols, not let you wouldn't have to worry as a user.
Yes.
Does that mean that the iBroker has more? In here, you implied the iBroker is storing this stuff for you in case you drop your wallet in the lake. Is it also doing things like transforming claims from one system to another, or did I misunderstand that?
It could absolutely do that, no question. And that's why, again, so earlier I was talking about OpenID and SAML in terms of authentication protocols iBrokers would support in order, you know, for interoperability there. Absolutely the same thing applies, that all the iBrokers that we're working with are planning on implementing InfoCard. But again, they're actually not going to serve necessarily in the role of an identity provider, although they would turn around for the user self-assert. If the user wants to have InfoCard for their iName, right, and it's a self-asserted card, but it's actually, then in that case, the iBroker is the identity provider, because they're going to say, yes, I registered that for you. I can attest that really is your iName, and you can authenticate against it. but there's many other info cards where they'd only serve in the position of a third-party storage. They're not the identity provider, and they could also help with claims transformation.
Quick comment.
Let me show you.
Hello? Could I just make a comment here? I don't know if I'm the only one in the room so far, but I haven't seen anything that relates to the actual topic so far. I've seen demonstrations, which are really good, and we talked about the products, which is very good, and we talked about open interoperability. But I just wonder about the actual topics of this particular breakout, if in the last half hour we could kind of veer towards them.
You said have the iBroker, you know, in this particular example, I think you just said that they're vouching for that person's identity. But what are you actually vouching for?
Actually, it's the identity provider that provides the cards, for instance. If they're the ones making the claims about the user.
I'm curious about, okay, so there's no standards for VeriSign, just what GeoTrust. GeoTrust is a low assurance provider. They match up domain name. I think there was a smart move on VeriSign. If the high assurance standards come out, then they can upsell all that. But where does the high assurance SSL, when there is a, even if it's not official standard, but you guys say it's a standard, you guys, the ABA browser vendors, and then how do you see that sort of evolving into high assurance identity? For individuals, and then the interoperability between users, the individuals, and those websites. And then to even take it one step further, which maybe I shouldn't, but when the merchant's website that I'm on, if I'm going to, you know, I have to, if it's like a,
you know, the corner hat store that I got online, but it's not, you know, a big brand name. How can I, it might have a high assurance SSL, but how do I know that they are actually in the business of selling what they claim to be selling? Because I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the SSL, high assurance SSL, doesn't,
right,
you know, check on the actual product.
So the question more is about how do you verify claims,
no,
as opposed to just identity?
No, well, there's identity for the individual and identity for, right, the merchant. What's the vetting process, the verification process that they are who they say they are? And then the next step would be, in terms of the merchant, what is the verification process to their actual product? Who's
going to
take responsibility
for
Michael?
Right. So I was a founder of an e-commerce company that I sold to VeriSign back in 2000. So this is sort of my business traditionally. It's changed a bit. But I will say that there's a couple things to keep in mind, that SSL does not per se make any assertions about what's actually being transacted at that website. It will vet the organizational entropy that goes with the SSL. The organization name gets bound to the certificate. But there are things that are attestable, and VeriSign in particular has a practice. That's why we're here in some ways. VeriSign is a service provider that is trying to integrate and amalgamate these protocols in such a way that we can provide meat space to digital binding, right? So for an identity, for an individual user, there are processes and techniques that we know for saying that Mike Jones is Mike Jones, and he has this particular credit card and this particular eBay ID. But also as a merchant, we can say not only is there an SSL certificate for Jim's Hat Store, but as a payment processor and a merchant banking provider, or at least one in that business, we can, for instance, say we understand the category and product codes that go through the payment stream for that particular merchant as a part of the process of clearing their transactions. That is something we can attest to formally, and if you trust VeriSign in to view the transaction and categorize it, we can say, yes, it's retail goods, and it's in the category of, what's the word I'm looking for, haberdashery, if that's what you want to use. If you can either decide you want to trust that assertion or not, but we can provide you even with some fine-grained metrics to say, yes, this is a high-volume narrow channel merchant, so they sell a lot of units only in this category. They only do haberdashery, and that's it. Okay, you can make that trustable or not, but those are the kind of units that we can ship digitally that you can put into your trust formulas and say, this information provider VeriSign knows who the merchant is, and they know who I am as the consumer. I have an information source that lets me make a trusted, informed decision as to who I'm dealing with, even if they're very small.
So let's move the topic a little bit and talk about one of the things I saw coming out of this as I looked at the panel was that there's a new this whole space engenders new business models. There are opportunities for businesses to spring up. I mean, we've talked about iBrokers, although we haven't talked about them in terms of businesses. We've talked about them in terms of functionality. What are some of the new business models that come about because of interoperability in the identity space?
So I wish that Bill Washburn from Apinity was here. he's actually in a different session right now, probably presenting one of his new business models. But he's also given us permission to speak to friendly audiences about some of their thoughts. So Apinity is a company that produces reputation claims about a person based on public information. So they might, they're in the process of producing identities now on an ad hoc basis used in places like Match.com that contain assertions about what is your actual gender, what is your date of birth, have you ever been married, have you ever been divorced, do you have a criminal background, and other claims like that might be considered useful in a dating context. And there's a lot of other kinds of contexts that you can get information from public records where their business becomes making assertions that Dick Hart would choose to trust about his dating partners that he might not want to have to verify, you know, experientially. I'm always glad to have you here, Dick. Why is that possible? It's possible in part because, you know, we together are providing plumbing whereby Apinity can make a set of claims that, you know, they're backing, and it's, you know, a business choice whether Match.com wants to use those claims, and it's up to Dick whether to submit his information with his Apinity card. But because we're making the presentation of claims much more seamless, all of a sudden Apinity's thrilled because they don't have to, like, invent software and get Match.com to deploy it and potentially put software in browsers. It's just seamless. And, you know, Louise could be presenting mannequin parameters in this same way. We didn't think of my virtual model. We didn't think of the Apinity things. We're not thinking, you know, we didn't invent this. New businesses are going to arise.
But I have just a quick answer. I see there's two kinds of new businesses. When you have a system, the iBroker is that thing in the middle, right? It's the thing that works on your behalf to present things so that you can actually buy the book at Amazon. And then what it's presenting is coming from what we call very poorly an identity provider. Should have been called an issuer. That's the. And mm-hmm. I think there are business opportunities for new kinds of brokers if we're trying to settle on a term for that thing in the middle. And there's new opportunity for new businesses making new kinds of claims about you. You know, the Match.com example. You know, a personal favorite of mine is that, is because I work for Doc, is people's information about their preferences, their Chevy Cavalier or whatever car they want to rent or not want to rent, should be something that they can be a participant in monetizing. Turns out, you know, that traditionally the merchants have the CRM systems and are only too happy to hoard and hold and own their customers, when in fact you ought to own yourself. And believe me, it's a good business owning yourself. Yep. So we actually envision a complete inversion of marketing. We envision people being participants in a business ecosystem where they actually make money off themselves.
User-centric identity. Let me just add a use case that I think is interesting to us that may not be obvious but could be important commercially. If you have a set of claims in your profile, say that you're 39, that's information that you can trust to another third party. But there's a business opportunity for a service provider to stand in the middle as an intermediary to say, I'm not going to tell you that he's 39 because you don't need to know that he's 39. For this transaction, you need to know that he's over 18 and therefore qualified to enter into this transaction, and that he lives in the state of Nevada for whatever this particular transaction is as well, right? So VeriSign sees a provider space developing where we say, we know on behalf of this user enough qualified information about their particular age to say this person is over the age of 18, or, for instance, could be between 14 and 16 to qualify them to get into some MySpace controlled and moderated forum that doesn't allow adults, right? But it won't tell you if you're 14, 15, or 16. That's none of their business. They're just bracketed into particular spaces. That's a dynamic claim. It's not a piece of data that's shoved around. It's an assertion based on knowledge that an intermediary knows that protects the user, from having that information that isn't necessary for the transaction to be floating around.
Good.
Yeah, hold on. Could I just ask this question briefly? I think those models are incredibly compelling. I'm just skeptical as to the extent to which businesses are in fact going to embrace them, given how much of an ownership they already take over user-generated data. And so one thing that I'd suggest perhaps the panel could address is not just the technical feasibility of interoperability in principle, but also the resistances, the various counterforces to interoperability. Because the ownership of that metadata is incredibly contentious. Right. From the world of DRM, everybody who's vending digital content sees tremendous value in being able to deliver content in a personalized fashion to individuals. But everyone who's making a business out of that right now has no interest in splitting revenue with consumers, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I'll say that is sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the room here. And if this becomes a theological discussion, and there's no getting around it. You either believe that at some point the users are going to develop and invest equity in their own profile, even and not just techno dweebs, but your mother-in-law, to be able to say, I have a click stream and an attention stream, I have entropy that I own and I can control, And I, at some point, will avail myself of infrastructure that will provide a balance of power where I actually reach a tipping point. Now, either we do or we don't. But VeriSign, at least in our division, in our practice, and I think many on this table, believe that user centricity is more about more than just being a user-friendly experience. It's actually about equipping that user to say to Amazon or these walled gardens that are out there, tough, or look, I own this data, and in as a group, as a mass, we have more power than you do in managing risk against us than the reverse sense.
Just a quick follow-up. I completely agree, but trying to get everybody lined up, you know, to herd those cats together and say, now stand up for your rights as cats, understanding the nuances of this environment. You have rights. You generate data. That data belongs to you. That data should be protected. Protect it now. That's going to be a very, very difficult educational curve, and so I hope that this conference establishes a high watermark, you know, that says, to really get that done, to realize that vision, how are we going to give the user side not just compelling use cases, but teeth?
Right.
Because without it, they're not going to give up ownership of metadata.
Agree.
Well, actually, this is fascinating. First of all, there are some things that are so important, but people won't pay for it. It's weird. Privacy won't pay for it. Christine's been telling me that for years. And this information that I said is worth, you know, a trillion or two, won't pay for it. But if you set it up on their behalf, don't charge the person for it, protect their privacy, and begin hoarding your own stuff, if you could call that hoarding. You know, it turns out the merchants are really bad at customer relationship management. And I won't name names, but there are people in this room who have off the record, maybe over drinks, will admit that the data that's in their CRM system is pathetic. And then if you look at the average e-commerce site and you say, I mean, in print, you can't personalize a brochure. Everyone gets the same brochure. And on the web, you'd think, you know, when I show up, I might see, you know, if I like to ski, I might see, like, snow. But no, I get the beach. And then we were playing a game with Priceline guy, who's here, Glenn, and saying, you know, let's name the websites that dynamically customize. They didn't say personalize. We don't need to know who you are. I just need to know your preferences so that we send you to the right place. So it turns out that, you know, there's a lot of this hoarding and control, but how good are they at managing and servicing the customer? Turns out, not that good. So they can do better if they actually let the customer say, once and for all, aisle seating, vegetarian meals, and don't repeat myself.
Hmm. Joaquin?
Well, Paul answered that question beautifully. So I just want to say, we have to be concerned that when we have all these programmers having fun with our ideas and developing code, that they watch out for buffer overflows. And we have to be concerned that we watch out for holes in our designs that inhibit what we're talking about. In other words, we want to make sure that the technology enables and actually assures that we can accomplish what we want to do, along the lines of the questioner and Paul's answer to it. We need to be really alert to that. This is like a real serious security problem in our design.
So let me answer that and then get back to the previous question as well. I mean, this is part of why we think it's good that all of this work is being done based on open protocols that people are vetting, that, you know, we've had IBM Zurich's security experts looking at the authentication and signing protocols, and we've had, you know, others in this room and others that are known to people in this room looking at the designs to make sure that there's not a big trap door that people can walk through.
I just wanted to follow up on some of the discussion that's already emerging here about the incentives of various parties to get involved in this ecosystem. I mean, we've talked a little bit about incentives to become an identity provider, although probably not enough yet. I'm still not persuaded why lots of people jump in with both feet to do that. But moreover, I'm looking at it from the end of a relying party, deciding what cards to take and deciding what identity providers to trust in terms of particularly authenticated information, but even otherwise, because a lot of for privacy and also for user control, it depends to a large extent on having a diversity of types of identity providers to draw from who make different ranges of choices about minimization of disclosure, about privacy, about the types of information you have. To do all that and still have it be a user-friendly, seamless experience, you know, you need a decent pool of identity providers, and you need big sites like Amazon to be willing to accept identities from all of them. I don't see the incentives that drive, and I'm using Amazon just because your demo does. Amazon, in fact, is probably a bad example of this, but you know, the large sites, the bigstore.coms, why don't they say, hi, please go get an identity from our partner over at, you know, bigidprovider.com, and that's what we want you to do.
They're going to start doing that here very shortly. Everybody in this room, when we use the term identity provider, you think about that company up out there, okay? Every one of you is an identity provider, and you give each other identities all the time. And every website you go to that you want to have anything more than a public relationship with, you are the identity provider. And today, it's a username and password. Now, there are two forms, two things, which in the next, well, I can't speak for Mike, hopefully 12 months, but we're going
to... Hopefully less than 12 months if you're going where I think you're going.
I was just using a large thing, but... Both of these metaphors for how you as an individual will be able to start to provide the very most basic element of your identity, which is a way of just an identifier and the ability to authenticate it. Both of these metaphors, a digital address or an information card, are going to be enabled in the market. The digital addressing method of being able to at least authenticate is already now, you know, with OpenID 2.0, going to become an option now for any website. There's a company here, Janrain. Scott Covetton, the new CEO, is here with us. Janrain produces, their whole business right now is produce libraries for websites that will be able to accept either URLs or INAMs as digital identities. I mean, they can do it right now. Very shortly, it's going to be, you know, and in all the languages. So sites can start to enable themselves for that. And with InfoCard and the client libraries for that, there's and Higgins, the ability to at least provide your own identity and do your own authentication is going to be something that just hopefully in the next year, before we meet again, starts to ripple across sites.
I just had to say, could, you know, possibly, option. Hopefully. I mean, I hear all of the possibilities. I understand the architecture is open and available, but I don't understand why I, as a user, won't just continue to do Bill McGovern, password Berkman, and I don't understand why sites will be particularly interested in accepting you know, lightly authenticated stuff from a variety of sources. I'm still not hearing the incentives.
Right. So, I mean, so a couple of points I'd probably add in response to that, or even to the earlier question on business models, because fundamentally information is an asset today, right? And that's where, why do I need to give it to somebody else, or why do I not need to control? So from a business perspective, they need to have incentives. Forget the end users only, right? I mean, from an end user, if you give 1,000 bonus miles, then people are ready to give preferences. I mean, there's this chocolate story around. I mean, there's a survey done with a chocolate bar to say, give me your password, you'll get a chocolate, and people gave up, right? So from that aspect, if there is a business value cost, for example, managing user information, be it just password, user ID and password, managing them, changing them, all of that. So depending on the business infrastructure, maybe large corporations are willing to do that because that's not only an asset, that's in addition to other information they need, but more and more they can get to that to say, well, I can cut my costs if someone else can do it for me and I can just subscribe to it, this identity provider. That is a business value for them, and then that will drive. For example, we can go ahead with cash from an end user perspective, but the convenience of plastic helps, and convenience from a merchant not to trust every check or cash and dealing with it. So there's business value and cost that come into play, and then the user convenience. And so it's a balance. I believe the user-centric discussions is more about swinging the pendulum all the way from the institution-managed thing, but not necessarily all the way, because there's going to be user convenience and business value and somewhere in between, depending on what kind of business we deal
with. There are two different kinds of, there are two different kinds of incentives we've been talking about, just to make sure we're all clear. The question up in the back was really about what are the incentives for identity providers to embrace these systems. The question over here was about what are the incentives for relying parties to embrace these incentives. And I think the panel's done a pretty good job of discussing those, but I want to make sure we had it clear that there were two different sides that we're incenting on. I mean, from my personal standpoint, you know, I just was setting up some media wikis not too long ago, and I loved that I could enable them to accept OpenID simply because I don't want to have to deal with all the usernames and passwords. And so I think there are lots of people out there who are running websites who would love to not deal with this problem, and that's probably the biggest incentive I can think of. Mike, you had a comment?
Yeah, as far as the relying parties, I mean, don't ignore that there's a massacre going on out there. I deleted 5 emails about changing my PayPal account last night.
You didn't do it?
That's all. Oh. I'll leave that to you.
It's got a good spam filter.
Yeah. Well, the good ones, right? It's not good out there. And people understand that the username password ecology is part of the problem and not part of the solution. And so for any relying party that I've talked to that has anything of any value, they completely get that moving to stronger authentication with fewer fraud modes is 100% in their interest. As far as the question about, how do we move an Amazon to being willing to share your profile data with you. And this is in the would-could space, but, you know, it could become a competitive differentiator if a BarnesandNoble.com started being willing to do that with you. Others, all of a sudden, you know, just to play ball with the empowered user, the next site might do it. But I understand there's an ecology that has to be bootstrapped.
That was a part of the challenge. But the other challenge is really the migration of user-generated and user-related metadata across environments to enable personalization across environments. So even if, say, Amazon is happy to do that with me, does that mean they'll permit me to extract my Amazon-related behaviors out of Amazon into the next environment, whereby I generate value out of my experiential history,
right.
And that which is the target that ideally people would be personalizing toward, which I would be leveraging to monetize things like my attention and my data and all that good stuff. And I just haven't seen that there is going to be a great desire from the service provider, content provider side to dispense with control of that particularly valuable asset.
I just want to say quickly, you're very right in that the existing, call it control structures that exist around that data are very powerful. Mm-hmm. There's no question what we're dealing with here. I think we should all keep this in mind. This is disruptive technology. This is highly disruptive technology. And the adoption curve is going to be exactly what Christensen talked about, which is we have no way of predicting that. We always refer to Amazon. How many want to bet that Amazon's not the not the one that takes advantage of this? It's going to be the bookseller. In fact, I will point out there's one. I think Brad DeGraff is here. There's a site called Books We Like, which is they don't even sell books. But what they do let you do is aggregate your own book buying preferences and do that with others. And then you start buying through them. And in fact, once they start doing that, it won't matter if it comes from Amazon or someplace else because it's your profile that's buying the book.
If BarnesandNoble.com lets you take your asset with you as a user on the system, that becomes a competitive advantage for them versus Amazon. So at some point, this is disruptive, and there's going to have to be a competition. It'll be a tipping point, and it'll happen fairly quickly if we ever get there. You get to a point where people are saying, hey, I've got this asset. Amazon won't let me take it with me. I'm going to shop at Barnes & Noble or
books
yeah,
we like.
Yeah, but don't you see that in the way that you're framing the, this standardization effort, if you can call it that, that there's a high likelihood of its drifting downward toward lowest common denominator, meaning users reveal a maximum of data to get a minimum of return on that data to a small set of dominant transaction partners, at which point the cat's out of the bag because the data which they have provided is now no longer a tradable asset which they've kept out of the marketplace.
Well,
because
you still have...
I mean, isn't there a serious danger that once you do it, when you set the defaults low, hoping good things happen, what happens is not is a low return for the user dispense of data as a result, and then you can't put it back again because that's in the nature of the stuff.
There's a reason why the status quo is the way it is, right? So that's one thing we have to keep in mind.
Mike, you?
No.
Okay. Let's go right there. Can you turn your mic on? Do you have a mic?
We've been talking mostly about consumer applications for these identities, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. How does this affect enterprise identity, enterprise single sign-on, and those types of things, which are huge issues right now in the enterprise community?
I can take a stab at that. I mean, the one of the key aspects that we do look at, not only from an end user viewpoint, is enterprise viewpoint, for example, managing identity data. Right, across multiple systems, directories, HR systems, and so on. So that's where it's not a token discussion. It becomes data discussion. So the concept around identity service and identity attribute service, so you can aggregate, federate information across multiple systems, come into play. So that concept, I mean, we worked with the Higgins team, and that's been part of the architecture now, so that you can plug in multiple context providers across. So that's one aspect of the enterprise. The other aspect come into the single sign-on or token discussion. That's quite relevant in the context of WS Trust-like model, where there's already progress in that front end with respect to usage of WS Trust in the context of things like WS Federation or SAML.
Just speak loud. So privacy, liability, those kinds of concerns.
Yeah, how to juggle those, and will privacy in the end simply be sacrificed because that's the business imperative?
Well, sacrificing privacy, if I understand you right, is the maximum exposure to liability. So the one way, I mean, VeriSign does this as the basic part of its business. A lot of the revenue that VeriSign makes every year is built around liability-driven identity verification, so SSL certificates. But there's more. Even in mobile infrastructure and other areas, VeriSign is in the business of spending money to investigate and verify attributes and identities in the real world that it surfaces to interested parties who are willing to pay a commission for that on transactions that take place between those parties. So VeriSign, in this case, for instance, would look at being able to verify your age and your name, a credit card, whatever. There's always liability when you're going to make some, if that's going to be used in a commercial transaction or a valued transaction, there's always a liability factor, implicit or explicit. VeriSign is one of many providers in the space that have reduced this to somewhat of an actuarial science, right? You understand that there's a insurance policy that you essentially write to govern or address any liability claims that come up as part of that, and it gets factored into the cost of actually delivering the service. So maybe you can give me an example of where you think the temptation for restricting the privacy would come right into play, and I can speak more practically to that example. Right.
You can't control that environment in which it relies on your claims. So how are you going to minimize that or make statements about not waiving my liability or protecting it? So the other thing, of course, would be on the business model side, how are you going to extract money from that? So you would have incentive there to go again through the line of parties, maybe on a case-by-case basis, so you can charge them like choice point.
Right.
Right? So I mean, all the drivers that a choice point has to be in
Okay, that's true. I understand from the choice pay model that makes more sense. I think in our practice that just becomes a disincentive to use VeriSign as a service. If people understand that is the driving policy to make that privacy barrier a secondary position, I wouldn't want to be a customer. I wouldn't want to transact in an environment where my identity provider is so oriented. So I think that just becomes the ecosystem sort of routes around those particular kinds of flaws. They become a liability themselves in the marketplace because you choose another provider that knows how to respect the trust and investment that you're going to make inside of those claims.
I did want to say something about that. Stefan's a little bit of a loaded question because his company produces some of the best technology in the world for addressing that kind of issue. What I wanted to say in terms of the role of the identity broker, again, I want to emphasize the one that stands in the middle as the representative of the user and has a fiduciary responsibility to the user. What I see happening already, because we're working with seven of these businesses and companies around the world that have said, we're going to make a business of this. We're going to go out there and we're going to start providing users with an iNAM digital address and the services. They're already now, they sit in that position like a bank, right, where they've got relying parties that are saying, hey, we would like this kind of information, right? And they've got users saying, okay, we might want to provide that kind of information. They're going to turn around and become the channels through which a lot of these business models get figured out, because they're going to sit there and say, okay, how do I facilitate this transaction to make money? You know, ultimately, some banks and some infrastructure providers made a lot of money on these. And once the system got figured out, then it's the people at the ends of the transactions. Same thing's happening here. And so if a combination of the technologies that enable it and the parties that can use it are going to start to come together in ways that none of us can predict right now.
So, Drummond, while you're on that topic, we talked about customer relationship management, and I can't remember, I think it was Paul that said that companies do a poor job of it. You have talked about a concept before that you call, Paul talked about customer relationship management. You've talked about the concept of company relationship management. How's that fit in?
That's where we all work for Doc. No, it's that came up in a session we had about 2 years ago, where it's really a very simple idea. Right now, the customer relationship management systems at all the companies out there have your data, and you're not really a party to that. If you had the data and could control it sharing with the different companies, then you're in a position to become Doc's fully empowered customer. We took a poll back then of the number of people that if you had the ability to express your preferences to a auto rental company, we'll do the poll again here right now live in the room. If you had the ability to express your preferences to an auto rental company, and let's say that these seven iBrokers all said, okay, we're gonna offer a car rental preference service, okay, and they all got together and they put out a press release. Said, we're going to offer this. And one car rental company stood up and said, okay, we're going to do that. How many people in this room would be interested in dealing with that car rental company because they made that choice? I mean, that's what we're talking about, you know, market power, of actually saying, okay, I want that. I mean, today we'll get out of that. I mean, Doc could talk better than that than I do, but that would be the start of company relationship management, where you can actually choose the data you share.
And you see that as an iBroker function or something that sits on top of iBrokers?
It's a service that iBrokers will offer. They will facilitate it. Yeah.
Okay. I'd just like to add that this is sort of my idea. That what you're talking about here is the ability to actually choose the car you want. In other words, you express your preference. You say, I'm coming to Denver. I want a four-wheel drive SUV with a ski rack, and they'll have that for you, rather than you just take your chances with it. That's the choice that we're talking about. Because right now their CRMs say, you're going to get what we give you. You get an intermediate car. Good luck. Right. Or you get the car they say, or similar, and it's always a Chevy Cavalier. That's the point.
That car is actually similar to everything.
Right. Yeah.
That's isomorphic to all objects. Joaquin.
I want to pick up on something that Stefan said, where he used the phrase waive or limit, and it was repeated again here with the phrase or similar. In the common law of the English-speaking people, when you are in the marketplace, there's a concept known as fitness. There's an implied warranty of fitness. In other words, if you sell a hammer, there's an implied warranty that it won't shatter when you're striking nails with it. Now, the people, a certain class of people, have invented a way of using contract law to repeal the common law of the English-speaking people without any action of the legislature. So they simply say, if you'll read the package, we do not acknowledge the implied warranty of fitness for purpose. And so my question for the panel is, suppose you have an iBroker and you want to get all your revenue from, let's hypothetically limit the revenue to coming from the customer. So you charge a dollar a year to provide the iBroker service, and you don't ask anybody to waive anything about fiduciary responsibility, and let's presume the common law puts you in as a fiduciary. Somebody else comes up, and they run a business for 25 cents a year, and it simply says click here, and if you don't scroll down and read it, you don't find that you waive any fiduciary responsibility that they may have. In other words, I don't read those things. I don't know if there's anybody who does read them, but it's the practice of the people who run the world to put down below the screen where you can't see it something that says, but we're going to do it however we want, and we don't accept anything that was part of the common law for centuries.
Tyranny by the EULA.
Yeah, so how are you going to compete as a dollar-a-year iBroker with the 25-cent-a-year iBroker that says we're not responsible for what happens to your data?
I think the short answer is reputation. There's a layer we're not talking about. When you have new services and you have a new ecosystem, you ultimately need to get the community feedback mechanism. So I think that's, you know, enough people have enough negative experience, and we need a way to track that. I'd like to think it's sort of a meritocracy and a reputation system.
Although Earthlink may. Anyone? No. Drummond.
I was going to say, as evidence of that, the iWorkers participating, again, in the iName-based brokering services, digital addressing services, self-organized a reputation working group that's going to become part of Identity Commons 2. There'll be a session tomorrow in the open space for anyone who's interested on Identity Commons. We call it 2.0 because it's a reformation of the original idea, and it's specifically to be a place where this kind of work can be done. But I was fascinated that the brokers themselves figured out that they were going to have this problem. They wanted, you know, they know they're there for the user, but how do the users know that? And how do they know if a broker goes bad, you know? So they're basically self-organizing, just the way the banks had to put together the credit card systems, because that's how they were going to be trusted. That's how the merchants were going to be trusted with their credit cards. So And reputation, I just, Jamie Lewis is not here at this session because he's at one of the other ones because he thought that's where the interesting stuff would be talked about. But he said that he thinks reputation may be the actual sort of killer business model for this whole space. And it won't be just reputation of the users and reputation of the merchants. It'll be reputation of the brokers. They're all going to all be the same thing.
So yeah, 1 minute. Final comments?
Yeah, in addition to the reputation, the other aspect is definitely risk. Not only the business does the risk evaluation, I think we do too. If someone is asking for, can maintain my address, physical address, which they can get anyway for 25 cents a year so that I don't have to type it anywhere else, I probably won't mind. Whereas I will mind if I have to store my credit card information to pay from a broker. So I think there is a, what am I risking if the data gets lost, come into picture. So there is a risk factor even from an individual perspective as well.
Final comments, anyone? No? Good. Thank you. You've been a terrific audience. I've enjoyed the discussion.